യോന്തപ്രവിശ്യമമവാചമിമാം പ്രസുപ്താം സഞ്ജീവയതി അഖിലശക്തിധരസ്വധാംന അന്യാംശഹസ്തചരണശ്രവണത്വഗാദീൻ പ്രാണാൻ നമോ ഭഗവതേ പുരുഷായതുഭ്യം. ടുഡേ ആസ് യു നോ ദ ടോപ്പിക് ഈസ് ഭഗവത്ഗീത, റീഇൻ്റർപ്രറ്റിംഗ് ദി ഭഗവത്ഗീത ഫോർ ദി മോഡേൺ മൈൻഡ്. Bhagavad Gita is known as the most important representative work of Hindu Vedantic tradition. Maybe after the Bible, it is the work that is being translated into the maximum number of world languages, both European and non-European languages. It has influenced great thinkers, great mystics, great philosophers, great social reformers, not only in India but outside. Well, to give just an example in the context of American history, most of you know the short poem by Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Brahma. A very, very short poem, just 4 verses. The opening verse is a literal translation of the 19th verse of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Emerson wrote this poem in 1956 and it was published in the Atlantic magazine, sorry, not 19, but 1856. He completed writing this short poem in 1856 and was published in the next year, in 1857, in the Atlantic magazine in November. The opening verse of Brahma, maybe apparently it is the most well-known and maybe the representative literary classic, very short, of American literature. The opening verse is, if the red slayer think it slays, or if the slain think he slain, they know not well the subtle ways, I keep and pass and turn again. Except the last line, all the first 3 lines are exactly a translation into English of the first 3 lines of the 19th verse of the second chapter. Nayenam vitti hantaram yaschenam manyade hadam ubhau tau na vijanito nayam hanti na hanyade. This is the verse. What it says is, we are not this body mind complex phenomena. This body, this mind, and all that we normally interpret to be our personality, the visible physical body, and invisible mind and emotions and feelings, all of them are subject to changes. But behind these changing phenomena, there is one unchanging eternal reality, and that is Atman. That is the all-pervading divine spark. You may call it the spark of God if you are a monotheist. And then the translation, the one of the most well-known translations of this verse is, he who takes the self to be the slayer and he who takes it to be the slain, neither of them these knows. These 3 lines are literally reproductions of the first three lines of the 19th verse of the second chapter. It does not slay nor is slain. That is a more accurate translation of the Gita verse. But for Emerson, it is, I keep and pass and turn again. It means the I, the real I, which is not the physical body or the mind or the intellect, but what is behind this physical body, the mind, intellect, emotions. That Atman, that absolute reality, He remains there all the time. It is eternal. It cannot be destroyed. It is indestructible. It is immortal. Now I am giving this example just to point out how even long before Vivekananda came to this country in 1863 to attend the Parliament of Religion, it's the beginning of the opening of American culture, American tradition to Vedanta. Long before that, in 1857, this short poem was published in the Atlantic magazine when Emerson had already written it 1 year earlier. So this is the influence of this Gita. So this is a very important point, historically speaking. So what is so special about Gita? To consider Gita as a religious work will be very, very unjustified. If you can think of religion as universal spiritual idealism, then you may be justified. Gita is not necessarily just a religious work, like the Bible, the Quran, or any of those books. Gita is all about the human urge for breaking the barriers of body, senses, or desires, emotions, and feelings. The natural universal urge to transcend the limitations imposed by the world of senses and the world of body. That is the real significance of Gita. So somebody like Emerson, who actually happened to get a very inaccurate translation of the Gita from Thomas Carlyle. He was a British social critic. Himself was not a great student of world religions or anything. He was more of a social critic who wrote about French Revolution and things like that. But Emerson got a copy, a very, very inaccurate translation of this book, Gita. And that translation was done by a most unlikely man, a humble semi-literate clerk who was employed by Lord Warren Hastings, who was the first Governor General when the British, you know, the British played one group of Indians against another group, and finally, with the help of Indians, they got a whole India under their control. And Bengal was the first province to go under the British rule. And Lord Warren Hastings was the first Governor General. He was a very broad-minded person. He was a highly cultured aristocrat who was a member of House of Lords in England. And he had a humble clerk in his office. His name was Charles Wilkins, who did not know much Sanskrit or anything about Indian philosophy, but somehow he got this Gita translated into English, into the English that he knew. He was not a great literary figure. And that was published with a very thought-provoking foreword by His Lordship, Lord Warren Hastings. He was a decorated British aristocrat. And in that foreword he says, long after the British Empire has ceased to exist, Gita will continue to survive, to remain relevant. The world of Gita will never cease to exist. So you can see wonderful, interesting coincidences, historical paradoxes converging on this Gita. Essentially, the most important and the most representative theological, philosophical, spiritual classic representing Hinduism, which has got four Vedas, 18 Puranic books, and there are, in fact, if you go to any major library which keeps outside India, I'm talking about British Museum Library, one of the most exhaustive stock of religious classics, philosophical classics, is Indian philosophy, Hinduism followed by Buddhism of different schools. So that is the vastness of the corpus of Hindu philosophical spiritual literature. which can be maybe hundreds of thousands of works. Of which the Gita itself is an interesting example. Gita is very tiny. The pocket size Gita is smaller than the pocket size edition of the New Testament. You can put it in your pocket, nobody will notice it. That is the size of Gita. And that is a small, tiny fragment of a much bigger work, Mahabharata, which in a shorter version is more than 100,000 verses. The standard edition of Mahabharata is 100,000 verses. The standardized edition. And incidentally, we are going to launch a new series of lectures today, this evening at 6 p.m. online class. It is hosted by the Stanford Hindu Students Association. It's going on for the last almost 10 years. Today, we are beginning this series on Mahabharata. And Gita is a tiny fragment, 700 verses, divided into 18 chapters from that huge corpus of Mahabharata. That is very something interesting. And it became the most well-known religious classic of India. And incidentally, it was not an Indian scholar or Hindu pandit who was directly responsible for exposing this Gita to the outside world. It was a humble clerk who was an employee of the East India Company. It's a trading organization. It was not under British crown at that time, you have to remember. East India Company was not a big organization. It was a petty trading company. And the trading company was given permit in 1600 by the Queen Elizabeth. That's how the history goes. And they were given this monopoly to conduct trade in spices and cloves and ivory between India and European countries. And they were all fighting for this monopoly. The Dutch East India Company, the French East India Company, and so on. And that company came to India, and they played one king against another Hindu king, and finally they all together got a large part of India under its control, called today's Bengal. And his first governor general was the representative, was the vice, was a representative of the British crown. Not actually directly, because it just the country had not under come under British crown. It was a trading company, English East India Company, which is registered office in London, India office in London. And this gentleman, who was a member of House of Lords, who absolutely did not know anything about Hinduism, Vedanta, or philosophy, or even about his own religion, he was a member of the Anglican Church by tradition. And he got a humble, almost semi-literate employee of his company, humble clerk who translates Charles Wilkins, this Gita, into English. And that falls in the hands of the greatest man America produced in his literary cultural tradition, rather, according to me at least, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And he translates the 19th chapter of this work at the first line in his most well-known poetical work, very short work, the Brahma. This is how the story goes. So just give an example of the journey of Gita across continents and cultures and traditions, and because it represents the fundamental human urge for breaking the barriers of the world of senses, to look for something beyond, something transcendental, something that is eternal, and to identify one's own identity with the eternal truth. Now I'm coming straight to the text. The text is in the form of a dialogue between two soldiers in a battlefield. One soldier, who is a teacher, Lord Krishna. He was a statesman, a spiritual teacher, a philosopher, a very humble servant of the lowly and the devoted, but a most uncompromising person while dealing with evil forces. So it was a very, very interesting character, Lord Krishna. And his friend Arjuna, another soldier. So in the battlefield, one of them, Arjuna, becomes confused, becomes highly perplexed. He has in front of him a very important responsibility. What is the responsibility? To fight with the evil. How do we deal with the problem of evil? Especially when you are a very sensitive person. You don't want to do anything wrong in this world. You want to live a very, very pious life without hurting an insect, a fly. You want to live a humble spiritual life, like a Gandhi or Christ or Buddha, let's say. But then you have to face a problem. If you don't face the problem by running away from your responsibility or facing the problem, you'll be causing enormous damage to humanity. Think of that. Or yourself, you are a security guard, standing guarding a school, maybe kindergarten, where small little kids are studying, and there is a security problem, and you are fully armed, and there is a big threat, and you feel confused. Well, if I use my weapon against the terrorist or the evil men, I may be committing violence. I should not do that. Should I run away? And thereby indirectly be the cause of much greater damage, much greater violence. So if you run away from your duty because you consider it a bit unpleasant, it's against your sentiments. You don't want to hurt a fly. But your duty is to do something that involves hurting somebody who is trying to hurt everyone in the world. So what you should do? You should try to do what is essential if that prevents greater evil from, if it saves a lot of people from greater evil. And that is the predicament in Arjuna. Arjuna is in the battlefield. He had to fight with terrible evil forces. And he was a very violent, he was a very, very strong, very brave soldier, you know. So he says, in the beginning of the dialogue in Gita is this, you know, Dushtremam Sujanam Krishna Yutsum Samubastidam Sidanti Mamagatrani Mukhamcha Parishushadi Vebhudusha Sari Remi Roma Hashasha Jayade Gandivam Samsade Hasta Tutcheva Paridakhyade. The Sanskrit verses you should rather excuse, because the original scripture, I want to just give a touch of the original thing. This is a verse, 28th verse of the first chapter of this work. It has got 18 chapters, 700 verses. The first chapter, Arjuna is putting this question to Krishna. I am becoming confused. Imam Swajanam Dushtva, seeing all these people who are my own people, but they are trying to do terrible things. They are trying to do so much of violence against everyone in this world. And my duty is to protect others from this. What should I do? So he says, he is facing a great confusion. This is the 28th verse of the law of the first chapter, sorry. The first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Now, at the end of the, towards the end of this chapter, Arjuna says, Nashto mohas midilibdha tat prasada maya achyuda sidosmi gata sandeha karishe vachanandava. Remember, see that picture. The beginning, the humble soldier, who is a very sensitive person, who doesn't want to do it, but unfortunately he happened to be a member of the military. His duty was to protect the poor women, children, others from evil. So he becomes confused. He says, I don't know what to do. And at the end of the 18th chapter, he says, Nashto mohas midillabdhva tat prasadat maya achyuda sidosmi gata sandeha karishe vachanantava. At the end of this chapter, the same man says, no, I am totally free from all confusion. I am totally free from all confusion and worries and doubts. I shall act according to your instruction. Now this is a metaphor. Gita is a metaphor. Battlefield is a metaphor. The dialogue is an allegory. What should we do when we are faced with the problem of doing something that we would rather not do, but it happens to be our duty to do. It's very similar, for example, a doctor as is a professional medical practitioner. He has to perform a surgery which involves violence, but you know, a knife in the hands of a surgeon and the knife in the hands of an assassin. Both are knives. In the hands of a surgeon, it becomes a tool for saving human life. In the hands of the other person, it becomes a tool for taking human life. So, at the end of the work, Arjuna tells Krishna, I am free from all doubts and confusions, I shall act according to your instruction. What did he actually do? He said, I shall act according to your instruction. What did he do? What did he do? The last verse of this text will tell you what he did. Yatra Yogeshara Krishna Yatra Partho Danudhara Tattasi Vijayo Bhudit Dhruva Nidir Matir Mama. This is the last verse. What it means is this. Wherever there is Krishna, and Krishna is again a metaphor for spiritual wisdom. It's a metaphor for philosophy, spiritual wisdom. And Arjuna, Yatra Partho Danudhara, literally means a man who is armed with the tools to do his duty in this world. So, action and wisdom. Krishna's spiritual wisdom and Arjuna's dynamism in action. That's why Schopenhauer, Paul Deussen, Max Müller, and Emerson, of course, as we mentioned, as we saw just now, they were highly impressed by this book because they didn't think this particularly a book about one religion in India. Rather, it is a spiritual manual for the entire humanity. Anyone who wants to combine in his life action and contemplation. You know, if you are only interested in action, the problem is we all do work. We cannot keep quiet for a split second. Gita says, Nahi kasikshanamabhi jadu tishtadi akarma krita. What it means is, we do not and we cannot keep quiet for one split second. Physically, we may remain inactive. Maybe you're sitting in an easy chair, doing nothing. You're relaxing. You're not acting. You're not active at that time. But your mind is hyperactive. So we cannot remain all the time inactive physically, emotionally, intellectually all the time. We are somehow active, if not physically, at least intellectually, emotionally, we are active. So action is unavoidable, inescapable. And action creates problems, as you know. Every activity produces lots of good results, unfortunately lots of unpleasant results also. So how to face the problem of the unpleasant results emerging from our own action? So Krishna says, so you have to combine action and wisdom. So when you combine wisdom and action, then on the one hand, you will be able to do what is what you're supposed to do, which anyway you cannot escape. Because even if we try to escape from our duty will chase you. That's an important thing. We may try to run away from our responsibilities. The responsibility may be a bit unpleasant at present. And we try to run away from it. If you do that, what happens is an unpleasant responsibility will be coming up for us. So we cannot really remain inactive physically and mentally all the time together. So what should we do? We should bring in another element into our life. That is wisdom. And wisdom means this. Do everything, whatever you're doing, with a sense of sanctity, sacredness, and again, a much more difficult thing to practice, detachment or non-attachment. I shall explain what it really means. So what happens is, frequently, actions do not create problems. This is what Krishna says. Our obsession to what we are doing and our obsession to enjoy the results of our actions, to enjoy in a very selfish manner. We want to completely enjoy all the good results of all our actions. So that creates a kind of obsession, being obsessed. And we know that it is certainly not a very good thing, because obsession creates phobias, anxieties, worries, and also it drains our mental energy. This is a very important thing. It is not activity that makes us tired and fatigued. It is our own identification with what we are doing, the strong desire, our selfish, obsessive desire to enjoy the results of our action, that creates problems of anxieties and worries. So if we can do whatever we want to do in our life without much worry and anxiety, it will be a very wonderful thing. Students studying for examinations, preparing for higher jobs, people doing business. Naturally, these are different activities. Again, Gita is not a book that you use only within the four walls of a temple or a church. Gita is a book that we can hold in our left hand and refer when we are working with our right hand. That is the importance of Gita. It would be very easy for Krishna to tell you, God created this world and God is offering everything for you and you do whatever I want. Here's a long list of do's and don'ts. If you obey, everything is wonderful. If you don't obey, we'll take care of you. That would be very easy for God, for Gita to talk like that. But Gita doesn't say that. That is the greatness of Gita. If you find a man like Emerson, who was not a Hindu or Indian, or a man like Paul Dewson, Max Muller, MacDonald in 20th century, or even close to our own times, great men, in many great men and women in different parts of the world, who have absolutely nothing to do with Hinduism or Vedanta, but they think Gita is a book that we would rather read and be benefited. You may be working in Intel or Oracle or Apple, wherever it is, and you are not going to a temple or a church. You may say you don't believe in God, so Gita you can make use of it. Lord Krishna doesn't close his doors if you say I don't believe in God. Gita doesn't even ask you to believe in God. That's something very interesting. That is the greatness of Gita. Gita says, if you become a good human being, and becoming a good human being means G should be capital, H should be capital. If you become a good human being, it means having peace in our mind and don't do anything that will create problems for others. Perfect harmony and friendship, broad-mindedness, we're dealing with others and enjoying a kind of inner contentment within ourselves. What is the source of the contentment? Not because Gita tell you you can go to heaven, have wonderful things there. Gita doesn't say that. It's something very interesting. Rather, Gita condemns certain ancient rituals practiced in India. Yakshe dasyami modishchit yajnana vimokidaha aneka chitta vibhrandaha. There are many, many verses in the Gita which tells you something interesting. In ancient times, let's say Gita goes back to 3rd or 4th millennium BC. So maybe before that, there were many traditions in India. We used to preach about going to heaven. Heaven means if you perform some rituals, you can go to heaven and be in the company of gods and goddesses. More like the gods and goddesses of the Greek religious traditions, you know. So when you talk about the polytheism of Gita or Vedanta, you have to understand a little about what Homer talks about Odyssey and Iliad, where there are many gods and goddesses in the Greek heaven. That is the kind of world that Lord Krishna is not very compatible, not very friendly with. Krishna says, it's not enough to perform rituals. But rather it's important to become a good human being. And that is the essence of true spirituality. And that is the essence of true religion, Gita says. So he says, whatever may be your duty, do that duty. You will be students studying schools and colleges. You will be professionals working in different professional circles. You may be diplomats. You may be politicians. Even Krishna was a great politician. The greatness of Gita was that Krishna says, politics is not bad, but politics should bring harmony and peace and contentment for everyone in this world. Not only for people living in one country, but whole humanity. So Krishna says, the essence of spirituality is become a good human being. And this goodness can be expressed, should be expressed in practicing unselfishness, compassion, friendly feelings for everyone, looking upon entire humanity as one spiritual family. That's what Krishna says. So that's why at the end of the text, Krishna says, there's a very, very famous verse. What he says is very interesting. I shall just read out, you know. He says, Yatra Yogeshara Krishna, Yatra Partho Dhanudara. Krishna Yogeshara. Krishna is a philosopher, spiritual guide. He is the wise man who teaches you about spiritual wisdom. And Arjuna represents action, activity, that you have to do something for your own sustenance. But activity alone is not enough. The most successful person in the world, the richest man in the world, highest paid professional in the world, may not be the happiest. Frequently it will be the opposite of reality. When we work hard, lot of obsessive desires, attachment, phobias and jealousies and rivalries, and make huge pile of, let's say pile of huge amounts of money, billionaire, trillionaire. But then we find we cannot enjoy the fruits of our own labor because mind is sick. Mind cannot enjoy. That's a problem. We may work, we may succeed, but success only in business, success not in life. Well, because to be successful in life, it means you should be able to succeed, and also you should be able to enjoy the results of your success. That doesn't happen. So Krishna says, let us combine action and contemplation. The wisdom, the philosophy, the ideal of non-attachment, detachment. I shall explain this detachment can lead to a lot of misunderstanding. Detachment doesn't mean you should not be attached to your near and dear ones. That's not at all the meaning. The meaning is this. Suppose a person, he is very much aware, he may be a very wise person, well-educated person. He's very much aware of the problems of this, what you call modern, the monopoly, the tyranny of science and technology. The tyranny of, you may call success in business management, so on. We know that, as I mentioned earlier, the richest man may be the unhappiest man in the world, the least happy. We find this paradox in modern times. So you may be aware of the problems of empirical success without a spiritual element. And you want to get out of it, but you cannot. You find this in drug addiction, in gambling addiction. You can find this in internet addiction. You can find this all over the world in modern times. There are many things we are fully aware. They are highly problematic. And we sincerely want to come out of it. But we feel totally helpless. So that is a more terrible and unbearable problem. Remember, when you are not aware of a problem, so you don't make an attempt to get out of it. That is manageable. But suppose you are fully aware of a problem and you know that you have to get out of it for your own survival. You're struggling. You're totally helpless. You're trapped. You're imprisoned by our own jealousies, rivalries, worries, and our own obsessive attachment to desires, to worldly pleasures. We know it's bad, but we cannot get out of it. This is a very, very serious problem. It is called attachment. It is not attachment of a mother for a baby, no. People sometimes misunderstand. Absolutely ridiculous, you know. Krishna tells you, you should be detached with everyone. You should not love anyone. You should not have compassion. No, not at all. What Krishna tells you is this. When something imprisons you, you feel you're trapped and you want to get out of it. And then you cannot. You feel totally helpless. That state of mind is called attachment. And to the art of getting out of that is called detachment. So Krishna says, you can practice this detachment. Why? How? Everything in this world is essentially impermanent. Now, this is something everyone knows. Nobody, if somebody tells you the money you have in the bank is going to remain there without any change all time, you're absolutely stupid, because banks may collapse, stock markets may collapse, whole industries may get maybe relocated, you may lose your job, all these things happen. We know that very well. So, but that awareness doesn't translate into any kind of spiritual common sense. Intellectually we know, but intellectual understanding awareness doesn't translate into emotional common sense. So when we make use of what we know in our everyday life, it is called common sense. Common sense doesn't have any definition. Common sense simply means making use of what we already know. That is common sense. So Gita tells you, when you remind yourself of the fact that everything in this world, youth, strength, money, status, success, job, everything, these are all needed. These are very, very wonderful things. But they are not going to be there all the time. Every child, every kindergarten child knows this. It's not a new intellectual knowledge. But the point is, we are not able to use that awareness, knowledge, in our everyday activities, everyday transactions, interactions with others. Krishna says, when you look upon every duty that you have got, with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. This is my duty. I should do this to the best of my ability. But I know that even if I succeed more than my expectations, still I may be happy, but that happiness will one day become unhappiness. Again, happiness will come again. So happiness and unhappiness, success, failure, pain and pleasure, all these come and go, they interchange. This is something we all know, but we are not able to remind ourselves of this when we face everyday situations. So Krishna says, when you combine action and contemplation, when you combine activity and wisdom, Yogeshwara means the Lord of Yoga. Yoga literally means connecting our mind to higher transcendental wisdom. That is called yoga. Yoga doesn't mean standing on your head. Yoga actually teaches you to stand on your feet in a spiritual sense, really speaking. But yoga gives us a tremendous sense of self-confidence, power, our own identity. Yoga means connecting. Yuj dhatu. Yuj actually means connecting. Connecting with the transcendental. So when we connect our mind with the transcendental wisdom, it is called yoga. So Krishna is a metaphor. He represents yoga. Arjuna represents all of us who are working in different places, different professions, different social, national conditions. That is Arjuna. So Krishna says, when we combine action and contemplation, it is called life. It is called yoga, yogic way of life. That's what Krishna says. Now he talks about, that's interestingly, for historical perspective, he talks about some ancient traditions. In the fourth chapter, the first and second verse, Imam Vivasude Yogam Proktava Nakamabhyam Vivaswan Manave Praha Manu Ikshakavya Bravid Ivam Parampara Praptam Imam Rajasya Vidhu Sakale Nakamahada Yogo Nashta Parandava. Two verses in that is the fourth chapter, first and second. Here the teacher Krishna is talking about an ancient lineage, a hierarchy of great philosopher kings. They were kings because they were active, they were successful, they were dynamic, they were efficient. At the same time, they were not working as slaves, they were working as masters. So Krishna talks about, Gita talks about working as a master, working as a slave. When we do our duty with complete dedication, efficiency, enthusiasm, and in a successful manner, but without being obsessed by a selfish desire attachment for success. But do our best. Now, that is that's the psychology of a philosopher king. A king is successful, he has to be successful, but he's not just a king, he's also a philosopher. Rajarshi. Rishi is a name given in ancient times to sages who could always see beforehand what is yet to come. To give an example, if you read some of these great books, you find great kings and emperors used to visit these sages. And every year they used to go to Vedic hermitages in the forest regions for consultation. And then when they go to these forest hermitages, the sages will talk to them. The administration is doing well, everything is fine. But remember, every year, talking about ancient times, you know. So that's the time of monarchies, non-democracy. Maybe 3,000, 4,000 years before Christ, 3rd, 4th millennium BC. So these sages used to advise kings, you should practice dharma. Your power, your wealth, your efficiency, your status, your position should be properly utilized according to the principles of dharma, according to the principles of virtue, morality, ethics, egalitarianism, justice, and so on. So that's why Krishna says, wherever there is this combination, this harmony of wisdom and action, material success and spiritual wisdom. Spiritual wisdom tells you should succeed in material life. But remember, all material success will one day disappear. So the reality of the fundamental impermanence of all material success, that is the voice of a sage, that is wisdom. At the same time, you should not be inactive, negligent, you should be active, dutiful, efficient, and so on. So the combination of the wisdom of a sage and the efficiency of a king, that should be the ideal. Now this again is a metaphor. In modern times also this is possible. When we live in modern times, when we are making use of the tools of science and technology or artificial intelligence, whatever it is, we should remember science and technology and artificial intelligence should not be allowed to take over human civilization. There is always a possibility of some kind of neutrality. We become immoral, we become morally and ethically indifferent. That's one danger of obsession with the latest developments of science and technology. Especially when the barrier, the dividing line between real, the real and the unreal, the truth and its opposite, becomes so vague, because you can create an artificial world, you can create an artificial you in modern times. So very often there is a great danger. Maybe this could happen within next 10 years, where Human beings can totally lose a sense of what is real, what is unreal, what is right and what is wrong. What is wrong in being wrong? Why should we be right? The question may arise. Why can't we tell a lie? So lie is an alternate interpretation of truth. Lies is looking at truth from another angle. The real unreal equation could really vanish. That's a big danger of the most explosive, the cutting edge barriers of science and technology. So there we can see the importance, relevance of wisdom when Krishna talks about it. But wisdom reminds us of something that we may know. You had to remember the great scientists who are creating new technologies. They are very intelligent. Intellectually they may know very well what we are talking about. But their understanding doesn't influence their actions. So there the problem arises. Krishna says one should always remember science and technology, the tools of secular prosperity, the tools of a king, which is called Rajarshi. Raja represents the metaphor for material prosperity. Sage, Rishi, is a metaphor for wisdom. If it, without wisdom, action alone, success alone can bring us to downfall. So Krishna talks about yatra yogeshara Krishna, yatra partho dhanurdhara. So there should be an active person who is a representative of secular prosperity, and yogeshara who is a representative of spiritual wisdom. Then he says, what will happen? Then there will be justice, prosperity, expansion and sound policy, sense of stability of social order, justice in society, prosperity for everyone, and there will be perfect harmony and peace among human beings if there is this unique synthesis and harmony of spiritual wisdom and material success. Material success we cannot run away from. Even without science and technology, we won't be able to eradicate poverty. We won't be able, even dictatorships are being able to liberate hundreds of millions of people from poverty to middle-class level of prosperity in recent times. Not only democratic countries, even great dictatorships are being able to lift huge sections of humanity from poverty, from starvation, from backwardness to prosperity and success. So science and technology do have their place and relevance, but then they should be guided by spiritual wisdom. There's a great message from the Gita. I think that's the most important message of Gita to modern times. Justice, prosperity, victory, stability and harmony. All these, that is, the Gita, Lord Krishna says, Sri Vijaya Bhudi Dhruvaniti. All this says. Sri means prosperity, then justice, that is proper sense of justice for everyone, and victory, stability, harmony. All this will happen when there is a harmony of spiritual wisdom and science and technology and material action. It's a great message from Gita. So we're trying to give a very short bird view of the teachings of Gita. And thank you. If you have any doubt, you're most welcome to ask questions during interaction Q&A session after the lecture. And after the music, we'll have Q&A question answer session in Vivekananda Hall. You are most welcome to ask questions and have a discussion. Thank you. Namaste. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.